From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. 30 years ago or so, American society organized itself in a very different way from today. The older system was built around land and family, tradition and class. Today, we want to live around people who think like we do. The journalist Bill Bishop says this new order is based on individual choice. He says handpicking your community is really a political decision, and it's having a profound effect on the country's public life. In his new book, Bishop says like-minded groups squelch dissent. They ignore contrary evidence, and they grow more and more extreme in their thinking. Today in the program, Bishop will join us to talk about this social transformation and its consequences. We now live in a giant feedback loop, he says, hearing our own thoughts bounced back to us by the things we consume and the neighborhoods we live in. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Progress and technology have given people more choices in the places where they settle and make their lives. And over the past 30 years ago or so, Americans have been moving around, sorting themselves into just the right community. In his new book, the journalist Bill Bishop says when you contemplate a move, you run through the checklist of amenities. Is there the right church nearby, the right coffee shop, good schools? But he says Americans also make distinct choices about who their neighbors will be and who they want to share their new lives. Americans, he says, have been forming tribes, finding people who look alike and think alike. Bishop describes these decisions as political, but he says this isn't just about political partisanship. There's something more fundamental at hand, a kind of self-perpetuating, self-reinforcing social division that he says is having a profound effect on the nation's public life. Today in the program, Bill Bishop will join us to talk about his book, which he says is the story of real differences in the way people think and what they value and how they worship and finally where they live. The book is called The Big Sort. Bill Bishop has worked for papers like the Lexington Herald Leader in Kentucky and the Austin American Statesman in Texas. He and his wife, Julie Artery, also owned and operated a weekly paper in Texas. They now co-edit The Daily Yonder. It's an online publication that covers rural America. His book, as we said, is called The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. He co-wrote it, we should say, with Robert Cushing, a retired sociologist from the University of Texas. And Bill Bishop is joining us today from NPR member station KUT in Austin. Bill Bishop, welcome. Thanks for being with us. Hi.
Thank you.
We should say, I guess, at the outset here that that your own personal experience really informed the book. I mean, it turns out you're pretty typical in some ways. When you and your wife settled in Austin, you were sorting yourself, I guess.
Oh yeah, our key was bowling balls in the front yard of a neighbor's house. Well, we did the typical moving thing. We flew into town. We rented the Taurus at the airport, and we started driving around. And my wife is the daughter of the last New Deal liberal in Kentucky, and she would draw these little smiley faces on the map where we felt comfortable. And we went through this neighborhood where a neighbor had their front yard decorated with bowling balls, and we thought, man, that is cool. So that's where we want to live, and we did. And we ended up moving into a precinct that, where in 2000 George Bush came in behind Ralph Nader.
Did you know the political makeup of the neighborhood, or as you say, you call it a kind of a vibe that you feel, or was it more a vibe for you?
Oh no, I guess we knew it subconsciously. It's not anything we talked about, but we all know these things. We can see it that in our neighborhood had this. The typical, you know, the front porches, the people out walking for dogs, the houses are close together. Mm-hmm. Proximity is a good marker now for whether you're in a Democratic neighborhood or a Republican neighborhood. And we didn't talk about it, but that's where we ended up.
You talk about this having this, you know, neighborhood selection, community selection, sorting ourselves as having this really important, significant effect on the public life of the country. When did you first start noticing all of this? When did you start writing about it and thinking about what it all means?
Well, we started, Bob Cushing and I started looking at why Austin was doing so much better than Kentucky economically. And we could see that a lot of that had to do with where people with skills and with education were were placing themselves. And we could see the beginning in the 1970s, places, people with education began to cluster in particular places. And those places where people with education clustered began to produce more technology and more patents and more ideas, and their incomes went up. And then parts of my Kentucky just began to just descend into some economic oblivion. And we thought, well, if there's people are sorting economically and educationally, maybe they're sorting politically too. And we could see that that was happening.
Mm. Throughout the book, you tell these stories, kind of personal profiles to illustrate the points you're making. I wanted you to talk about Stephen Mason, if you would, a man from your community, learned kind of a hard lesson about being a political minority in the age of the big sort.
Steve, we have a neighborhood news group, like a lot of places do, and you know, we find lost dogs and report broken in vehicles, and Stephen lived in the neighborhood, and he went to Texas A&M. He's a good, strong Republican, and Stephen had it was just the slightest. Election. It was an election for the board of the local community college, if you can imagine. And he recommended that people vote for this particular person who he said was conservative. And as people Googled this man, they found out that he was against gay marriage and gay adoption. And there was this immediate response from the news group. And the sense was Stephen had to be expelled. And he had to be one of the people wrote, okay, as a member of this list, I'd really like to see this political discussion disappear. As a lesbian, obviously, I'm not going to vote for anybody who doesn't believe I shouldn't be allowed to adopt kids. As a resident of Travis Heights and a member of this neighborhood list, I'm not interested in having this kind of discussion here. And that was repeated over and over again, and eventually Stephen left. He left the news group, and he said he wasn't proud of that. And it had another effect on Stephen. He has a dog named Hotard, and he walks the dog around the neighborhood, and he began to wonder what people were thinking about him and what they were saying about him. And that's the kind of process that you see happening in communities that have majority political groups. People vote less if they're in the minority. People are even less likely to join in community events or community projects if they're in the minority. They withdraw. We had people tell us that when they went to book club, they would just be quiet. In west of here, in a highly Republican community, the Democrats built a float for the July 4th parade. And when it came time to run the float down the main street of town, nobody would get in the float. No one wanted to be identified as a Democrat in a highly Republican community.
Do you come to the conclusion, just personally, I guess, that this is really a shame? I mean, beyond the sort of social consequences, which we'll get to, that it's really kind of sad.
It's happy and sad. It's like most things. It's happy and sad at the same time. It's happy because we have these thousands of incredible human experiments in how to live.
Yeah.
It's sad because we miss diversity of opinion. And it's particularly sad because, as a nation, the politics of the country demand that these different groups come together at some point and compromise and come to the best decision for the country as a whole. And we can see in Congress that that's just not happening.
You say in the book that this is a deeper question than just whether or not the country is polarized. That's probably not the right term when we're talking about all of this. And you say there's a kind of social specialization that's going on, that we're really forming these, I think you called them isolated islands of our own, of people who think like we are, like we do.
Well, yes. And that was a term that historian Robert Wiebe used for the 18th century American, that America was a group of island communities that rarely had interaction with each other. And what we've done is kind of returned to those island communities. And those island communities aren't based necessarily on income or class. They're based more on communities of interest. So you have, you know, if you're a marathon runner, you hang out with other marathon runners. And I had a woman from San Diego describe herself the other day as an ocean-oriented person, and and she hangs out with other ocean-oriented person. And what's happened is that those communities of interest now define the way we live, and they also define how politics is being played out.
You know, it's so counterintuitive in some ways because we're in a digital era where we can reach out globally, yet as opposed to being less isolated, in some ways we're becoming more isolated. Is that fair to say?
I think so. And the technology has given us more choices, and given a choice, people choose to be around those who are like themselves. It's a perfect human reaction.
You know, it didn't used to be this way, and you spend some time in the book talking about how we used to order our lives. You say a different system of order, that it was, land and family and class and tradition and religious denomination. So how did we organize ourselves before? What were the things we built our lives around before all of this started happening?
Well, of course, earlier we had incredible racial division.
Sure.
And still do. But the clubs and the institutions that helped create this country were more broad-based. You went to the neighborhood church. When you joined a club, in our little town of Smithville, the Rebeccas would have their dinner, and everyone would be there. The guys from the volunteer fire department would be there, and the ladies from the cafeteria at school would be there, and the mayor would be there, and the bank. And there would be these places where there would be cross-fertilization of ideas. And it's not so much people hearing different opinions. It's really the sense that that I know Joe over there. Joe's a Republican, I'm a Democrat, but our kids go to the same school, we know each other, we're at the Elks Club together. We have some basis for friendship that extends beyond politics. And now, and that used to be true in Congress too, where Bob Michael, the Republican, and Dan Rostenkowski, the Democrat, both from Illinois, would share a car back and forth to from home to D.C. And now people come into congressmen come into D.C. and they come in on Tuesday, they leave on Thursday. And a lot of times they live almost a dormitory life with other members of the same party. And so they don't meet each other at school plays or in the Senate gym or on the weekends at brunches. And so those kind of human relationships that are so important to government have just been lost in this partisanship and in the technology that demands that these people attend to the concerns of these particular niche ideological groups.
Bill Bishop, is it because politics at some point became something more than just, a perspective about government, that it became connected to something deeper in the way we think about our values, this idea of morality, for example? It seems to have this connection to – it seems to be defined in almost moral terms, politics now, which – do you think that explains some of that?
I think a couple of things happened. One is class declined as a marker of parties. And what replaced it was what we have now in the country in general, and marketers are really good at tapping into this – is extreme self-expression. And as people grow up in relative abundance, their attitudes about politics begin to change. They're less concerned with issues of survival and the economy, and they're more interested in the issues that such as environmental protection and individual rights and gay rights. And so our whole attitude about politics has changed, and it's become more a reflection of ourselves rather than our class or our community.
Bill Bishop is with us. He's author of the book, The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. He's joining us from NPR member station KUT in Austin. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Bill Bishop is with us. He's been tracking a social transformation going on in the country. More and more people who live alike and think alike and, yes, vote alike, are choosing to live in the same places. This may be part of the answers to why the country is so culturally and politically divided. It's not the effect of some orchestrated conspiracy, but the simple fact that we've sorted ourselves into places where we feel more comfortable. Bill Bishop says in some ways the neighborhood you choose has become a political decision, and it's having an effect on the country's public life. His book is called The Big Sort: Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. Bill Bishop, I wanted to ask you about, you know, what it is that happened. Get some more of the specifics of how we sort of got to where we are today. You say that something happened in the mid-1970s where people started to, grow more ideological. Some say it was, you know, the 1968, that it was the result of the chaos of the 60s. You're not so sure about that. You say it's maybe a consequence of something more gradual. Talk about what's happening now in the 70s as we start making this change.
Well, let's go back to 65, which I think was the pivotal year.
Yeah. Point of no return, you say.
It was just the society came unraveled at that time, and a bunch of social changes that we're still dealing with started then. One was mainline churches, Lutherans and Episcopalians and Presbyterians, began to lose membership in 1965 for the first time in 200 years. The clubs that we were talking about earlier, the Rebeccas and the Masons and the Lions and the Road. Those clubs began losing membership in the mid-1960s. Bowling league membership, Robert Putnam tells us, peaked in 1965. People began to withdraw from the political parties and declare themselves more independent and began splitting their tickets when they voted in 1965. And also in 1965, crime rates and divorce rates began to go up. And at the same time, trust in government declined dramatically beginning in the mid-1960s. Before, when Lyndon Johnson was able to pass Medicare and the Voting Rights Act and began funding arts and humanities projects and founded the Appalachian Regional Commission, 8 out of 10 Americans thought that government did the right thing most of the time. That plummeted beginning in 1965. Johnson began losing Democratic members of the House and Senate in 1966, and the Great Society was over by November of 1966. And so as society unraveled, it had to come back together somehow, and as it came back together, it was not in these broad-based institutions like the Presbyterian Church. It was in churches that were designed for particular points of view or particular lifestyles. And it came back together in clubs that weren't broad-based community clubs, but ideologically pointed clubs like Common Cause or the Sierra Club, and then that extended to media too. Daily newspaper penetration was peaked in 1965 and then began to decline, and we began to find ourselves looking for media that reinforced our opinion, and so everything became more specialized, more niched. And more reflective of people's individual beliefs. And that's where we are today.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Jadea is with us in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Jadea, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I guess, digress for a moment. Earlier at the beginning of the conversation, you guys were talking about living in communities that would be, you know, use the example of the guy that was a Republican living amongst liberals. Well, I consider myself pretty far left liberal atheist, and I live in a predominantly conservative Christian Republican community, and I have good rapport with my neighbors. I have absolutely no problem. As a matter of fact, last week I was invited over to an older couple's house for dinner, me and my fiance, and I think what it is, it's a mutual respect for my convictions, what I believe or lack thereof. They understand, we understand. I guess we don't get into too much heated debates about policies and politics, but You know, I have absolutely no problem with my neighbors. My house is spaced. Our houses are spaced further apart. I thought that was a funny observation. You know, he said he lived in a community where the houses are a little closer together and people are more. But, you know, me, I guess for me, being as a liberal and atheist that living where I live, I have absolutely no problem. And it's probably 95% conservative Christian Republican. Hmm. And I think it's just based on my conviction. They see how I live. They see my morals. I'm not, you know, it's almost like there's a mutual underlining understanding. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Well, Bill Bishop, is Jadeb more more mature, more healthy than some of us, maybe?
Well, he's a heck of a lot more healthy than a lot of people I know, that's for sure. But you can see that, you know, one of the things that happens psychologically is that not knowing many people from with other beliefs, we kind of create in our own minds some sense that they're, you know, there's a monster loose, and you know, people don't win elections; they steal elections, and we become sort of a United States of those people. And what we're hearing from North Carolina is, you know, when you get to know people and actually do mix, everybody can get along, and I think that is true. It's just that we don't.
Jadea, glad you called. Greg is with us. He's in Centerville, Utah. Greg, welcome.
Oh, thank you. I was curious if Bill had I had read just recently the book Geography of Bliss, and it discussed Reykjavik, Iceland, in there, and they have a fairly monocultural culture there, and he talks about how it's one of the happiest places in the world that he had traveled to, and I was wondering if maybe it's not necessarily the culture, but maybe internationally, like culture. Monocultures are better, and maybe it's something other than culture in America that's causing tension. And
well, Bill, you take on this question of human nature, whether there's this kind of innate need to find, you know, safety in groups who are like us.
And the social psychologist will tell you that there is, and that we do feel safe in our neighborhoods. And in fact, I believe Robert Putnam's latest paper finds that trust is declines more in places where diversity is greater than in places that are monocultural. And so I think the problem that we have is, how do we go from our neighborhoods where we're happy, or else we, you know, that's the way we created our lives, to a country that has to put those different neighborhoods together? And that's the issue that's at stake here.
You know, what social science is telling us about group polarization is really interesting. One thing that you write about in the book was that in these groups of people who, you know, think alike, is that they get more extreme in the way they think as a way of actually conforming, which is, again, another kind of counterintuitive idea.
Right. What people have found for some time now is, one experiment was, you got a bunch of French students together who disliked America. You got them to talk for 2 hours about America, and by the end of those 2 hours, the group disliked America more. And there's this this subtle competition within groups that you don't want to be seen as an outsider, so you take a position that's slightly more extreme than the group, so you won't be mistaken if you're a Republican. In a group of Republicans, you won't be mistaken for a Democrat. And that process over time, as people kind of leapfrog themselves in terms of showing themselves in the group, pushes the group to the extreme. And I can see that in my – well, you see it in talk radio all the time. Yeah. You know, that you can see it in my neighborhood. You know, the last thing you want to be known in my neighborhood as is a Republican. So – elections, as I said, aren't lost; they're stolen. And Karl Rove isn't an interesting strategist; he's an evil genius, and it just spirals away from there.
Greg, glad you called. Thanks a lot. Back to the phones. Malcolm is with us in Salt Lake City. Malcolm, hi.
Hello. Yes, I grew up in a small town in Arkansas, and it was all walkable. Within six blocks, you could meet as a 12-year-old kid. Going into town, meeting everyone from the mayor to the shoeshine boy, and learning about all their lives and generating compassion for them, and being a rebellious early teen Tom Sawyer type, I would go, since we're in the American South, I would go a block over to the Black Main Street, which was an entirely different world, and you just learn so much about other people and the kids now, they have no conception of what I'm talking about because they're segregated and some would say imprisoned in suburbia, and their conception of shopping is you go to Walmart in a car, you don't talk to anyone, and that whole world is just completely lost to them. What does he have to say about that?
Bill Bishop.
Well, I talk to my wife often about living in Smithville, a town of 3,500, where we lived in the 1980s, where we did know. We knew the preachers, and we knew the bankers, and we knew the bums on the street, and that sort of variety was really invigorating, just as Malcolm said. And I think we are missing that. And one of the interesting things we found and write about in the book is that universities now are offering this specialized housing. So you can live in the environmental house or the jazz house so kids are used to living specialized lives from the beginning. And in fact, subdivisions now are being developed for particular political points of view. So there's a subdivision in Orange County where part of it has traditional colonial-looking houses with a Christian school nearby. And then in another part of the development called Terramore has bamboo floors and a Montessori school nearby. And so the kind of regular interaction that Malcolm describes that happens naturally in a small town is being programmed out of life from the time kids are born.
Malcolm, thanks very much. Let's go back to the phones. Shay is with us in Salt Lake City. Shay, welcome.
Hi. Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about the French students, how you were talking about that. I've noticed that, like, I consider myself just a Democrat. I'm pretty conservative on some issues, but when I'm with my more liberal friends, I tend to try to be more liberal than they are, simply because I don't want to be considered a conservative in front of all these liberals. And I think it's very true about the neighborhoods we choose to live in, because I'm very fresh to Salt Lake. And when I got here, I was like, I want to live in a neighborhood that's really liberal. And everybody, like, recommended Sugar House for some odd reason. And it turned out to be exactly like the way you described it, the everybody gardens, everybody walks their dogs, and it just has a more liberal feeling to it. And I just wanted to say, yeah, I think the person is completely, like, right on about everything.
Bill Bishop, you quote Holly Golightly in Breakfast at Tiffany's, it's useful being top banana in the shock department. This right. idea of conforming is really important.
I never thought of myself as a conformer, but when you were talking about the French students, I was like, oh yeah, you know, like, I tend to do that, you know, I'm pro-choice, but I'm not pro-choice like some of my friends are. I think there should be a cutoff, but when I'm talking to them, I tend to, like, be like, yeah, we should allow abortion after 8 months and 29 days, just to be more liberal than they are. I don't know. It's very weird.
Bill Bishop?
Shay is great. You know, and when you step outside and you hear this stuff, you begin to see. I mean, we almost live lives sometimes that are caricatures. I've talked on a radio show that was led by a guy who said he was in charge of the vast right wing conspiracy, and the ads for the show were about, like, how to get fluoride out of your water, and I kind of expected to hear about, you know, the aluminum foil manufacturer so you could line your bedroom, and then I switched over to the progressive talk radio in Portland. And the first three ads were for a Saab dealership, a wine tasting, and a book about how the last three elections had been stolen. And it's, you know, when you finally step out, as Shay describes, you begin to see that our lives are really being pushed around by the environment in which we live.
Hmm. Che, glad you called. Thanks very much. You know, it's one thing, Bill Bishop, to know the demographics or party of a particular place, and to know that Democrats, like you say, are more likely to own, you know, cats. But it's another thing entirely to act on that information and choose that you want to live in a place that thinks like that. I wanted you to talk about Donald Green, a Yale political scientist who explains how people end up picking their, you know, their political parties, how much effect that has on them. I think he describes two social events that influence that.
Right. You know, we talk about issues all the time on the networks and what issues that, you know, Hillary Clinton has and John McCain and Barack Obama. And Donald Green says issues, you know, that's not how people choose how to which party to belong to. He says it's more like going down a hall in a hotel, and there are two doors, and there are parties going on behind each door, and you open the door and you look in and you see how people are dressed and what they're eating and whether their kids might be the kind of people you'd want your kids to marry and whether they're people like you. And when you decide which group best reflects you, then that's the party you join. That's the door you go through, and that's the party you begin to vote for. But what's happening is those party allegiances have become so strong, they extend to all issues. So a friend of mine in Kentucky said the other day, you know, people ask me how I feel about gay marriage, and they know about how I feel about zoning regulations.
Yeah.
And so everything is becoming so aligned with lifestyle to party to personal beliefs that we don't have any room to move.
Let's take another call before we go to a break. Gene is with us, traveling through Utah. Gene, welcome.
Hi.
Yes,
I'm from Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm moving to Tucson, Arizona, and I don't know about Arizona. I know I left a bunch of Republicans behind. And I'm not, and I won't call myself a Democrat either. But the timeline that you were talking about, things changing in the 60s and the 70s, was really interesting because you managed to talk about it without saying anything about the Vietnam War or the generation change. And I think a lot of that could be, some of this result could be the result of the polarization that was brought about by the Vietnam War, and then the polarization between the generations, the generation that survived World War II and the generation of the good times of the 50s.
Yeah. Bill Bishop, that play a part?
Well, in 1965, at the beginning of 65, 20,000 American troops were in Vietnam. By the end of 65, there were 200,000 in Vietnam, and we began bombing North Vietnam during 19. So all that did happen and played a role. And the generational change is very important, but I still go back to the gradual changes that you were describing earlier that happen in Japan and in New Zealand and in Sweden. All those countries went through that same decline in traditional institutions like churches and they had the same decline in party affiliation, and they had the same decline in trust in government. So there were specific things going on in the United States, but there was a bigger change that was taking place in all these industrialized countries.
Gene, thanks very much for the call. Bill Bishop is with us. He's co-author of the book, The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. We need to take another brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the journalist Bill Bishop talking about his new book, The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. Joining us now is Greg in Indianapolis, Indiana. Greg, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
What I haven't heard here is maybe I missed it, but with the underlying word, racism. And I think that one of the things that is characteristic of racism is that people tend to say, well, everybody likes to be around people like them. And I think that's not true. for a large number of people who have experienced cities and experienced how having everybody have a place at the table really works, that we find there's a lot of richness in a diverse environment. But I think the politicians have found the easy way is to pander to people to, you know, who are like them, and to do just what the author is suggesting. I'm like you, and then everybody begins to sort out in their separate corners. When in fact, the strength we have as a nation or as communities is when everybody participates, and you get to have that richness of knowing your neighbors, and people can live wherever they want to live.
Well, Bill Bishop, you write about this question in a segment of the book called The Myth of Polarization. And it seems like the response you get, the answers you get, are not all that comforting. Talk about that.
Well, what struck me when Greg was talking is that we look at politics probably the wrong way. And we talk about issues a lot. And we don't talk about communities of interest at all. And so when Greg describes the joy of diversity in a city, he's describing a lifestyle and a community that today trends democratic. I was with a group of people yesterday who are into new urbanism. And a guy from the National League of Cities concluded that, you know, all this new urbanist stuff is creating neighborhoods that may be more diverse racially, maybe more diverse economically, but less diverse ideologically. Because basically, I spend a lot of time with Republicans on the outside of Minneapolis, and they told me they wanted nothing to do with downtown Minneapolis or St. Paul. There's some incredible diverse neighborhoods in those two cities that are just a blast for those that people who like cities.
Yeah.
Well, those are Democratic areas. Republicans don't want anything to do with them. They get it. They call it creepy. Republicans want some space between. And 30 years ago, that wasn't the case. 30 years ago, the average in the race between Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford, the counties that supported Ford were about the same size as the counties that supported Carter. By 2004, the counties that voted Democratic were five times larger, had five times the people as the counties that supported George Bush. We had separated geographically, and there was a gradient. The more people per square mile in a place, the more Democratic the vote.
You know, you hear these theories, you write about this in the book, that there are these theories that, in fact, most Americans find themselves somewhere in the middle. But then you present evidence. One is an Emory University political scientist, and Alan Abramowitz, who says, look, you have to understand the significance of what you describe in the book as these cultural markers. Abortion and gay marriage are among them. And, in fact, they show that most Americans don't find themselves in the middle, at least in that regard. Or am I reading that wrong?
No, two things are happening. Fewer people are in the middle on most issues, and there are more issues that matter. Traditional political science theory tells you that as one issue will dissipate and another one will take its place. What we've seen is a piling up of issues that continue to divide people. So instead of Social Security going away as an issue, it remains, along with how to pay for health insurance and what to do with public transportation and foreign policy questions. And they all begin to align with one another. And in fact, people are kind of changing their minds in order to stay with their groups. And some of the alignment can be correlated with people's belief in whether the Bible is inerrant. So these issues align with fundamental beliefs about faith and about family and about who's responsible for their own actions, and it's all balled up and it's all aligned sort of like toothpicks in a box.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. Bob is with us. He's calling from Sheffield, North Carolina. Bob, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to mention how much I've noticed on like TV news programs anymore. Instead of having real in-depth discussions of issues where they look at all sides, they tend to have two people at far ends of the spectrum and really presenting a with us or against us kind of attitude. And, you know, it seems like the media are really pushing people to the extremes. And I wonder how much that's affecting all of this.
Bill Bishop.
Well, there is Diana Mutz at Penn has done some great work on the how TV news works. And one thing you'll notice also is you get more close-ups. I mean, you're abnormally close to people when you're watching them on TV because there's a kind of a danger there. You know, you don't – if someone's that close, you're keeping an eye on them because they're, you don't know what they're doing there. And that anger also is attractive. You have to – if it's happening there, you're – it's like a wreck on the side of the highway. You have to look. And so a lot of this is just preying on our kind of, you know, ancient brains to attract attention. But Bob is saying is exactly right. You know, media now, just like products, Tide detergent and power bars and everything else, are designed for niche markets. And TV has niche ideological markets, and they're serving them.
Bob, thanks for the call. Here's an email from Vance who writes, I grew up and was educated in Utah, but I joined the Foreign Service and lived extensively abroad. On my retirement in 1992, I returned to Utah and was surprised to find living here the greatest cultural shock of my life. I found the society increasingly polarized from the time I left, and I felt increasingly uncomfortable. Even though I'm a practicing member of the predominant faith, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon faith, I often find myself uncomfortable in church meetings. Although we love being near family and some friends, we sometimes think we would be much happier living in a neighborhood where social beliefs were more like our own. Let's go back to the phones. Let's see. Jeannie is with us in Greenville, Tennessee. Jeannie, welcome.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that 10 years ago, my husband and I were both in corporate jobs living in Atlanta, and we opted out of that. He's Republican, I'm Democrat. We moved to rural East Tennessee, no zoning amid farmers and working class, and it's been the most eye-opening experience of our lives. And it's just, you think that you're socially liberal until you begin living among people who aren't like you, and you realize that you've always been pretty protected.
Huh.
And it's just been an amazing growth experience.
Bill
Everybody
Bishop.
Should try living among people not like themselves.
Yeah. Bill Bishop, how do you react to that?
I think Jeannie can start a movement. I'm with her.
Jeannie, thanks for the call. An email from Jean, who's writing from Brigham City, Utah. People are definitely conservative here in Utah, she writes, and tend to demonize liberals. It's obviously not unique. When I chose to move here after 20 years in the Navy, my sisters couldn't understand how I could live here. It's because it's so beautiful, she writes. One sister would like to be able to leave the country because she sees it as becoming too conservative. Isolating myself with people who think like me just leads to fear, hatred, and loathing, she writes. As difficult as it can sometimes be, here's to diversity. And let me ask you, in relationship to that, Bill Bishop, what are the consequences? These kinds of neighborhoods where we all think alike, you say they squelch dissent and they grow more extreme in their thinking and they ignore evidence that their positions are wrong. What are the consequences of just bundling together?
Well, I think that, I mean, there are a couple of consequences. One consequence is people are reinforced in their beliefs so they feel better about where they live.
And, yeah.
But the other consequence is it makes it harder for a broader area to come to any sort of agreement on anything. We are under the impression that everybody thinks like us because everybody we know does think like us. And so we don't allow our politicians to do their job, which is to make deals and to compromise and to take all those disparate interests and form them into some sort of policy that's best for the country. And that's really the problem. The problem is, how does a nation of these island communities, ideological island communities, resolve issues that we all have in common?
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. Dave is with us in Salt Lake City. Dave, welcome.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, what you said a few minutes ago really struck a chord, and that is that we just haven't changed much from ancient man. And I think the fact is we're still afraid inherently, biologically, of anyone who is different than we are. And that biological fear causes us to band together. It's kind of sad that we haven't really evolved past this. And, you know, we consider ourselves, for example, you know, a great Christian nation and all this, and yet religion is really the big divider of people. And, you know, it seeks to not only categorize and sort people, but also impose their will on other people. So when you have, you know, belief systems coming up against one another, it's the fact that you're trying to impose your belief that's actually causing the strife, not just that you have different beliefs, but that you can't allow other people to have theirs.
Hmm. Bill Bishop?
Right. I mean, that's sort of our common denominator now, yeah. that we have a nation of many cultures, and maybe the only thing we have in common is that we will allow each other to exist, and maybe that's the one advance that we've made over, you know, tribal societies. But to get back to politics, one thing that strikes me is that politics has become such a marketing effort, has finally caught up with marketing, so that persuasion is out. And I think the Bush campaign in 2004 was really smart about realizing that, look, people aren't there to be persuaded. There are very few people left in the middle. What we have to do is identify communities of people and move those communities to the ballot box and forget persuasion. Forget trying to form some national consensus. This is a question about identifying our candidate with particular communities of interest.
Thanks for the call. Here's an email from Angie who writes, have people quit thinking? Why do we have to be either conservative or liberal? In the example given earlier in the show, I myself find myself living in the colonial house with the bamboo floors and sending my children to the Montessori school. We attend church weekly and we're pro-life. We are deeply concerned about the environment and the decline of the traditional family. Don't give us a label, she writes. It could be construed as libel. Cramming everyone into a niche is how societies close. From Russ, he writes, being a liberal Democrat living in Utah has made me want to move to a more liberal area, even though I live in one of the most liberal cities in Utah. He lives in Park City, by the way. I think that this is, in fact, he says, your guest says this is not healthy. I think not, from the standpoint that even on the local level, the majority controls a lot of how you live. You're not exactly saying that it's not healthy to live in these communities, though, Bill Bishop.
I think we've not found a healthy way to get these communities to deal with one another. And part of the problem is that the communities have become so strong that they our elected representatives have no reason to compromise. They are representing people who are overwhelmingly of one opinion, and so that's who they represent. But I think individually it can be extremely healthy. So people in Portland, Oregon can pay their taxes for an incredible public transportation system or library system in Odessa, Texas, can put in a Bible course in high school. So, you know, we can really do a lot of things, but the real experimentation now is taking place at the level of the city where majorities are strong. Nationally, there's no experimentation at all.
Are you expecting, I'm wondering how people, if they're choosing to live together and to be like-minded, is there a point when there's a backlash, when they get a little tired of it, when they start thinking they want something else? Are you seeing any sort of transformation brewing that may change all of this?
Well, you know, one of the most interesting things I did was spend time with kids who are part of the emerging church. Hmm. And these are kids that are Bible-believing. A lot of them came out of the Baptist Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, and the Assemblies of God Church. But they grew up in these, as they described it, thou shalt and thou shalt not churches that have been created over the last 20 or 30 years, the mega churches. And they found themselves being ordered around to believe particular ways in massive groups. And throughout the country, there's in Denver, there's the Scum of the Earth Church and Sojourn in Louisville and Bluer in Minneapolis I went to. And these places are intentionally small. They're intentionally non-judgmental. And so I think there's a generational reaction to our boomer obsession with difference, and that's where the change is going to take place.
Bill Bishop, along with Robert Cushing, he's the author of the book The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. He joined us today from NPR member station KUT in Austin. Bill, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the show directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. Our thanks to Howard Berkus. I'm Doug Fabrizio.